going. Okay, now if we substitute psi into the wave equation, then we end up with this formula here, relating omega and k to c, okay? Now in the last lecture we talked about frequency and wavelength, and so, oh by the way, just for out of interest, this omega squared over k squared equals c squared, the ratio of the radian frequency squared to the wave number squared, that's referred to as the dispersion relation of a vacuum for electromagnetic waves. It's called a dispersion relation. And the reason why it's called the dispersion relation is it gives you a relationship between omega and k. Now, you may well imagine that one can have media, for example, plasma, left-handed metamaterials that have much more complicated relationships of omega and k. They're not necessarily straight linear functions like this particular one. This is obviously omega over k equals plus or minus c. Basically, electromagnetic waves can go forwards or backwards and they're plane waves. And as if you double k, then you double omega. Or, as you'll see in a minute, if you halve the wavelength, you double the frequency. And there's the relationship. You can substitute that relationship, if you like, up into the top formula, and you can then show that lambda times F equals C, as you know. Okay, so 2 pi over lambda is the wave number, or the wave vector, or the propagation factor, and omega, the radian frequency, is just 2 pi F, okay? Now, the exponential form represents sine waves propagation of unit amplitude, and with a phase that is given by that. Okay, so if you like, we just go back to this function here and we just put little phi in there for that, and basically we have a propagating sine wave. But the sine wave is shifted so that kx minus omega t is a constant. So if you picture a wave at the beach that you're surfing on, you move with that wave, then the wave looks like a sine wave, as long as you move in the frame of reference of that wave. Okay, waves with k greater than 0 propagate toward positive x, and those with less than 0 propagate toward negative x. Right, now, waves therefore experience a time delay as they propagate. Okay, this effect of radio waves is called retardation. It means that cause and effect are not instantaneous in electromagnetism, right? If you're on the phone and a lightning bolt strikes the power station, you have a good time equal to L over C, where L is the distance from the power supply station to your house before you're electrocuted. That'll turn out to be several hundred microseconds if you're a long way from the power station, but it ain't much. Nonetheless, they are retarded. Sinusoidal waves undergo a phase lag or a phase shift as they propagate. In the complex model in dissipative media, the velocity can also be complex. Now, I've only written down the equations there for our vacuum, and there's no attenuation and no dispersion in a vacuum. No dispersion, by the way, means that it has that simple dispersion relation I put up there, omega over k equals c. That's a linear relationship. That means you can propagate any phase shape, waveform. It'll always be transmitted undistorted in a vacuum. Now, it is possible to have media that are dissipating. Certain dielectrics, like wood, you launch an electromagnetic wave inside wood, it gets attenuated. That's expressed by a complex velocity factor. And I won't go into the mathematics of it. It turns out that k and never omega is complex. In our world, that's true, okay? And certain physicists who would like to see time decaying frequency, those looking at nuclear quadrupole resonance, for example, they watch electromagnetic waves just decay in time. But in our case, we're going to drive these signals with a function generator that sits there forever, okay? So omega is a real number, always. That's the answer to the why. The k, therefore, becomes complex. And if it becomes complex, you write it like this. If you substitute that now back into that original equation we had, e to the I kx minus omega t, then I can take the k naught x minus omega t out, and I'm left with e to the minus gamma x. What does e to the minus gamma x do? what does that look like? Anybody?
Dance
wave, exactly. The wave gets lost. In other words, if I start here with an antenna at 2.5 gigahertz inside the wood and I launch it, I'm sure it'll all be gone by the time we get to the end of the bench. All heating up the wood as a microwave oven would, okay? All right, waves with opposite signs of K interfere with each other if they're propagating right near each other, okay, in opposite directions, and they form what are called standing waves. And I use the analogy of the skipping rope in the lab out last week. So if K1 is plus K and K2 is minus K, then you have this very simple mathematical form. Now, in this course, when we get to transmission lines, because I'm going to abandon temporarily retarded fields in this lecture just to discuss some things. Electronic circuits are considered to be those for which the isolated circuit, part of the circuit you study, is much smaller than the wavelength. So retardation is not important. However, if we just for the moment look at retarded fields, this formula here will crop up again when we do transmission lines. And so if you understand it well, geometrically, and I'll make sure you do before we get there, then you can understand all about how directional couplers work, transmission lines work, and a whole lot of other devices based on transmission lines that depend on wave motion and waves being reflected. And it's only a one-dimensional problem, right? Transmission lines are often just cables, like coaxial cable, and they can be bent all over the place. But what I mean by X, of course, is it X?
Yeah.
X is the distance along the cable. And it mystifies me to this day how a coaxial cable like this, and I'm not even, it's not even coax because it's connected to a keyboard, but it's a multi-core wire, but a coaxial cable maybe like this thing could ever have simple dispersion like that. Even when you bend it. And I find that quite amazing. But anyway, you'd think that by bending it like that you would destroy the wave characteristics entirely and introduce dispersion as a result of the bend in the cable, but you don't. You try doing that to your spectacles. Smash your spectacles. Do they work? No, because the fractures cause the light to reflect all over the plate. Okay, it's possible to explain that away, but I still find it amazing that coaxial cable, like the one we have in the lab, can be bent. All right, anyway, going back to reality, if A1 equals A2, then we have this simple formula here, e to the I kx minus omega t with that minus sign there, and that simplifies to this formula, okay, where this is just a constant, e to the I omega t still oscillating. Look what's happened now to this wave. It doesn't propagate anymore, it stands. It's like the skipping rope stuck to the wall. The waves just go up and down like standing waves, okay? So that it comes entirely from that formula for wave motion. All right, so it oscillates in time, but the spatial dependent. All right, now I have a there we go. You can all see that. What is that? That is a picture of the voltage and current on a transmission line, which is long in comparison. In fact, it's 1.5 wavelengths long, yes. You can see it's 1.5 because this is a Java applet, by the way, and it works fine with Internet Explorer. I'm sorry to say, I have to get the plug-in for Firefox. Anyway, this is a picture of the wave as it propagates along the line. This is the distance measured in wavelengths. So at 150 megahertz, what's the wavelength, somebody? You should have a feeling for this, because you're going to build antennas later on. 150 megahertz, how long's the wavelength? 3 by 10 to the 8 divided by 150 by 10 to the 6 is 300 divided by 150 is 2 meters. Thank you. You know the answer, you can answer, right? Okay, then 1.5 wavelengths. So this would be 3 meters long at 150 megahertz. So we get a single generator, a 3 meter cable. I should be careful about that. The propagation factor on a cable shorter than in a vacuum. But suppose it was, and you can certainly have rigid coaxial cable that has an air core in it. So it's the propagation speed is really that of 3 degree space, 3 × 10⁸, 300,000 kilometres a second. But in coaxial cables, such as the one in the lab, it's more like about 200,000 kilometres a second, in which case it'd have to be, how long to get to 1.5? Not 2 metres, but 1.5 metres, isn't it, or something, right? Okay? It's got to be a bit shorter in order to have 1.5 wavelengths. Okay, so, but you can see the green there is the voltage as it propagates along the line. This is with a 3 metre cable. What's special about this cable? Can anyone remember from the lab last week? What do you have to connect at the end of the cable to make it look like that?
A
terminator. Yes, a 50-ohm terminator. We'll go through all that again today if you like. So the voltage, if that's the case, then the wave propagating on the line thinks that the line's infinitely long because the wave gets to the 50-ohm terminator and thinks it's still on the cable, and the current and the voltage march happily into the 50-ohm load, dissipating the power there, all the power there. So the electromagnetic wave carries power into the load, and nothing is reflected, and that's why you see this beautiful sine wave propagating. Mathematically, this is e to the kx minus omega t. Just that. There's no reflected wave here. We have a perfect match. Okay? But this was just a demo to show you what waves look like. Alright, just go back. Let's look at a standing wave now. With a short circuit terminating impedance, in other words, replace the 50-ohm line with a short circuit, now the voltage will be zero at the end of the line. And now look what happens. You might notice too that the voltage and the current are no longer in phase in this. This is a real transmission line. Remember the skipping rope? Now you can see this is a real skipping rope. The only difference between this and open circuit line is that this is the voltage is zero here. You can see the current's unrestrained, it goes up and down. Okay? Now let's look at a similar case, but with an open circuit on the line. Once again, we must have a complete stationary wave. Now the current is zero at an open circuit because it can't flow into nothing. It goes to the end of the line and that's the end. But because there's retardation in the fields, the wave is the current launches the wave, or a wave is launched at the open circuit that propagates back along the line and causes that interference I was talking about. This is the case of the cos kx that I just derived for you. And the voltage in this case flops up and down. It can be anything you like. So you can get an electric shock by touching the end of an open circuit line, but not by touching a short circuit. And just as a matter of interest, what happens if you get something that's kind of terminated? Kind of not really, like 20 ohms instead of 50. The forward wave is more power in it than the reflected wave, and you can see that there's something propagating forward now, but it's also bobbing up and down in amplitude. It's no longer constant in amplitude. Okay? So I think you're probably getting a bit dizzy now with all that, so I'll get on with the lecture. Alright, so there you've seen some wave motion. Does nothing, but those simple plots up there was absolutely nothing but plotting that equation out and getting these A1 and A2 right according to the boundary conditions at the end of the line. Okay, that's all there is to transmission lines. We'll revisit them a bit again and take them more slowly, but here's your introduction. Okay, oh, there's that cos kx factor with a short and open circuit line, just describes the wave shape. Okay, so it's always zero in the middle. All right. Getting back now to impedance. Kirchhoff's current laws and impedance. We're going to start actually by having a quick look at how these current laws are derived, because the main thrust of this lecture is to get onto impedance. First of all, you know Kirchhoff's current law. It means that the sum of all the currents into a junction in a circuit is zero. Seen that before? All right, so where does that come from? Well, we've already seen conservation of charge before. If there's no Q, there's no charge anywhere to start with, then J, the integral of J dot dA is zero, where we're integrating here over a closed surface. So let's look at a few of them in this circuit. Here's one closed circuit which has three junctions coming into it. The integral of J dot dA is zero. It's all over, right? J times A gives you the current, okay? And these currents happen to be highly concentrated about where the wire is, obviously. They're on the wires. And so the sum of all the currents when you integrate J times A over all of the area is zero. Does everyone see that? It's an immediate consequence almost without proof. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, there's only one tricky thing here. So these two are identical. What about that one? That's a capacitor, okay? What happens to a capacitor? Does it still work with this law? How does it go? Because look at the trick here. The trick is we have a current flowing into the capacitor plate there that crosses the surface here, but there's no other current crossing the surface. So what must be happening on the capacitor plate? Exactly. There's charge on the plate. I didn't draw it there. So you'd know it was there. Okay. Now, having said that, that's a useful thing to know and use it sometimes mathematically. But in real circuits, capacitors are kind of stuck together a bit. And so too close for you to bother with it. So you just have two leads on a capacitor. You don't ever get to see the internal bits. And so really that yellow surface must encompass the top plate, in which case you do get the current flowing into the top plate because the charges on the plates must be equal and opposite. Okay? Alright. Oh, I just explained all that in words, so there it is, you can read the book. Through capacitor, the current is continued as displacement current. Yeah, I might just make a comment about that. There is an electric field between these plates, however. Remember I drew a picture of a capacitor in an earlier lecture and had the electric field lines pointing between the plates. Well, those electric field lines behave exactly like current if you go back to Ampere's law. Okay, if you multiply epsilon naught by the electric field, derivative dE/dt, epsilon naught dE/dt, I think it's J plus epsilon naught dE/dt, that there looks like a current in Ampere's law. Well, precisely that electric field there, given by that formula, is the electric field that appears inside the plates. So you could consider that electric field to be the continuation of the current. It arises precisely by charge conservation, because you'll remember this term here is what we needed to guarantee charge conservation in Ampere's law. Remember that was Maxwell's contribution, apart from writing all the equations down. All right, so. Right, Kirchhoff's voltage law. Now, this is the interesting one. The current law is actually quite boring. Providing you believe that you're given, it's valid to assume that there are no retarded effects in the circuit. Now, I might go back to that and just point that out for you. I'll tell you where you're going to go wrong with retardation in this. First of all, if you move these surfaces here, I didn't actually draw one, I should have, along to here, so there's only current going in and going out. What happens if the current's one of those waves that I showed you in the Java applet before? I mean, the current can be pointing this way here, and you walk down here one half wavelength away, and it's pointing backwards. So that's definitely going to disobey the charge conservation, right? Is it? No, it's not. It's not going to dissipate charge conservation. Why? Can anyone tell me? If I've got a current down here, this way, flowing along a wire, and I come half wavelength away, it's pointing backwards, why does this law... This law still works, right? I sold this to you with a guarantee. That's till the end of the year. I think I've got a guarantee until the next big theory of physics anyway. So it's going to work. So what must be happening? If current's doing this, what's going on? There's only one thing left. The integral of J dot dA is not zero. Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that? Anybody agree with it? Oh, because it's... you need to look at the Java applet. There it is. Have a careful look at that. The current is the red curve, right? The current is plotted vertically, so I'll never catch it. They're positive, they're negative. Take a screenshot. Did you all get me there? It wasn't too quick. The current is actually changing sign along the wire. See that? It's actually positive for a time and it's negative for in a different place at the same time. And this law here, Ampere's law, applies at a given time. All Maxwell's equations apply at a given time. Better have your clock synchronised if you're working between Earth and Vega, but it's 25 light years away, but it's got to be at the same time. So how do transmission lines get away with it? What are they doing? What do you think's happening here? The voltage gives you the answer. Look exactly where the voltage is a maximum. Actually, it's better with that other outlet. Right, let me get the one with the standing wave. There, things are at least... What's going on, sorry? Where is the voltage a maximum? Yes, exactly. What do you think is happening, therefore, where the voltage is a maximum? If you look at Ampere's law, I think you can remember what's going on up there, but let's have a look at Ampere's law again. It's got that Q, hasn't it? The Q dt on the other side. So what do you think the transmission line's doing there? Well, if the current's all of these arrows are pointing into this blue surface at any given time, there must be charge in there, right? Or a changing charge is what's important. dq dt. Okay? That's the only way. And so what is it that's happening over here with the Java applet? Well, when the current here, when dq dt is a maximum, well, it's a bit hard, there's a phase difference in the time here, but the charge reaches a maximum. The charge is, in fact, you can show that the charge along the line, the unit length along the line, is proportional to that voltage. So what happens is that the current gets to be retarded simply by virtue of the fact that charge comes to the party in the conservation of charge law. In other words, charge accumulates right in the middle of these reverse sine currents. Okay? Charge is accumulating right in the middle there, and it's oscillating as a function of time. And that also happens in the propagating wave, except now the charge moves along the line as the current is. See, in the terminated case, where we had that beautiful wave, the current is still positive and negative there, right? But there's now charge on the line. You have to investigate the mathematical details of this, by the way, because to convince yourself that charge is being conserved, because now the voltage is in phase with the current. And so it looks like the charge is, for example, zero in the middle there. Okay? So you have to be careful of that. It's dq dt that's important here, not q. In charge conservation. So the answer is that the current gets to reverse sign like that, seemingly disobeying Kirchhoff's current law by virtue of the charge accumulation that occurs on the wire. There is charge conservation. And that charge conservation is integral to the ability for electromagnetic waves to propagate like that on the transmission line. It's part of the physical outcome. Alright, so we're not talking about circuits now where that occurs. That was a transmission line. Retarded effects are present there. Let's go back to our simple little circuit that's much smaller than a wavelength. This law applies on a wire, okay, because there's no way that is much smaller than a wavelength. There's no way we can get the kind of retardation that could cause a charge separation. Alright, so next we go to the voltage law. Remember that the current law sums the currents into a node. The voltage law sums the voltage around in a loop. So we want a law that will give us the integral of the electric field in a loop, and Faraday's law does exactly that for us. And how simple it is. It says the only way you're going to get a net voltage in a loop is with a changing magnetic field. So let's look at a circuit. I mean, there's a pic, there's a, oh, I've got the wrong, have I got the wrong one there? Yeah, I've drawn the wrong picture there, forget that. I'll put the right one up in a minute, next time. All right, we're studying small circuits at radio frequency. We've got the current is taken to be the same around an entire loop, and retardation is to be neglected, okay, and we're going to call this the low frequency limit. Let that blue dotted curve now be the curve along which we integrate the electric field. Okay? Alright. In actual fact, what I've done is it's impossible to draw properly unless you make that a more complicated drawing, but I want that loop to be on the surface of the wire being the black thing, the black line, all the way around the circuit. Okay? Now, look at what we've done. We've taken an integral along the wire, all the way through. We go straight through the capacitor. We come around, we have an inductor here, which is a coil of wire. We follow that inductor inside the wire, and we come back to the voltage source. Now, we're not going to get up to it in this lecture in the time frame now, but this application of Faraday's law has a simple explanation. Let's suppose the wire has infinite conductivity. There's no electric field inside that wire at all. Remember I was saying in the last lecture, when an electric field impinges on a conducting plane, the electric field is shorted out, short circuit, okay? You can't have an electric field inside a conductor, not a DC electric field. Of course, if the conductor has finite conductivity, that's different. Like copper, you can get some electric field there, but I'll show you that in a minute. For now, let's suppose this is infinite conductivity. Then if you go back to this law, this electric field is everywhere zero, except in a couple of places, or three places actually. Where is the electric field not equal to zero in that circuit? There are three places. Sorry? Yes, the source is one. That's a very interesting one though. Two interesting little notes. Because the source, we're going to sweep batteries and signal generators under the carpet in this course. We're just going to think of our sources as Stephen and Morton equivalents, but they have voltage generators that generate an electric field. They're like capacitors, like batteries. Yeah, that's true. That's one. Next one. The capacitor definitely has got an electric field across it. Okay? One more. No, not the inductor. The inductor is a perfect wire. It's made out of the same material as the rest of the circuit, so it's shorting. What does that leave us? Luke, what's it leave us? The resistor, yeah, the resistor has finite conductivity. We've got to give it finite conductivity, or it's not a resistor. I mean, it's just a part of the circuit, right? It's the wire. Alright, so they're the three places. If the capacitor weren't there and the resistor weren't there, then we'd have the electric field of the generator balanced against nothing, except for dBdt. Now that's the first strange idea that you'll have about circuits in Kirchhoff's voltage law. The inductor is different to capacitors and resistors in as much as the magnetic field that it generates is entirely external to it. And the magnetic field, principally in the vicinity of the inductor, that gives you the back EMF, if you like, that balances the voltage of the signal generator. So the inductor it concentrates the main changing magnetic flux in the circuit. But it's by no means a given that in a real circuit, particularly at radio frequency, that inductors are the only place where inductive effects can be visible. For example, these wires could have lots of external inductance and therefore have to be modelled. And you'll find that when you start designing circuits, that the strip lines that you use on a circuit board to connect one component to another are usually inductors of some kind, okay? We'll go into a bit more of that in the next lecture, those details. But let's start by going back to the very beginning about impedance, and let's look at conductivity and its effect in detail. This is the crucial part of it. The answering that first question in the web notes. In order the first problem you have is I just drew up a circuit there, which is a simple one, and I won't probably digress much from that after you hear what I'm about to say. But you have to define the boundaries that limit your current components at radio frequency. Okay. So these circuit components that we're going to need to deform that contour or that locus of that curve to go through these components in some way. And these components are going to be resistors, inductors, capacitors and transformers, and anything else just about in this course, including antennas, transmission line transformers, directional couplers, phase hybrids, and anything that looks suspiciously like a transmission line cannot be treated in the following fashion. But they can be treated as distributed versions of tiny components anyway. We'll see that too. All right. Well, here's the first rule. This is a rule about conductors, so we can start getting our heads around what happens with conductivity. Because of Ohm's law, there is no free charge inside a conductor. Not freedom, free charge inside a conductor. So let's apply current conservation. So here's J dot dA, and you know that's equal to minus dQ dt. Let's put sigma e in here for J. And let's also... Gauss's law, Q. That should be an epsilon naught. Yeah, that epsilon naught should be in the numerator. Sorry about that. So remember Gauss's law for the electric field. I'll just show you that. Jump right up to this one up the top here. Keep that one in your head. This leads to an astonishing result. All right, that means that the epsilon should be up there, okay, in the numerator. So dQ dt can be replaced by that. Now compare these two, and we have this law for a conductor, any conductor. And this is also true in the presence of retardation. Do you see where that comes from? You just equate the integrands in the second and the fourth formula there, and you have an incredibly simple law, okay? Look what it says. It says that electric fields exponentially decay with the time constant given by epsilon naught over sigma when inside a conductor. And sigma on epsilon naught, that's inverse seconds there. But look how big it is. It's a ridiculous number. Put in sigma equal to 10 to the 7 for copper, 5.8, 10 to the 7. Epsilon naught 8.85 by 10 to the minus 12. You end up with an enormous number. Unfortunately, that's inverse seconds. So that's this number here, sigma on epsilon naught, is multiplying that t, right? That t is not in that t is in the numerator. That's how long a charge lives when it sits inside a conductor. Now, not on its surface. We haven't covered that case here, but inside the conductor. There is no charge inside a conductor at any radio frequency. I mean, here we're talking, that can only happen on gamma ray timescales. That's a gamma ray timescale. So gamma rays, Ohm's law no longer works. Out of our realm, right? Under no conditions can charge appear inside a metal. Is everyone happy with that? That's actually quite a different rule to what you've seen before. All right? All right, now let's look at what happens. Can an electric field penetrate at all inside a metal? Now this is the crucial bit. It can slightly is the answer, and here's the proof. Consider the following diagram. This grey region here is a metal, okay, and it has a finite conductivity, okay. This is our air up here, or a vacuum, and this is the metal-air interface, and we have an electric field that's propagating in. Maybe it's a wave. And it hits the metal. So this is that mirror I was talking about. Okay, now we're going to look at the effects of having look what happens to the electric field inside the metal. What is it that gives rise to that reflected wave I spoke about in the last lecture? And this is it. Now what we do is we start by applying Faraday's law. And if you look at, let's consider this is a uniform problem in Y. It's uniform in X. And the positive z direction points downward. So there's z plus delta z, and there's z. If we apply Faraday's law, the line integral of e dot dl around that closed circuit, we get e y of z plus delta z minus e y of z
times L, which is the length of that circuit, and that's equal to dB dt, which is J omega L times delta Z.
It's actually minus dB dt, but it's also minus J omega, so it's J omega times that.
And that simplifies to this equation, a very simple equation. And the magnetic field is pointing in the X direction, which is out of the board. Those blue spots indicate that. Okay?
It's a one-dimensional problem. Now you can do the same trick using Ampere's law for the magnetic field with everything swapped.
So I've drawn this incorrectly. That should now be the X direction, okay? And this is the same magnetic field that was in that electromagnetic wave that came in the first place. And what happens to it?
Well, the magnetic field, you can use Ampere's law. And there are two terms in Ampere's law.
First of all, there's this JY, which was due to the electric field, because the
any time you have an electric field inside of a conductor, then J equals sigma E. So you've got a J, you can't ignore the J.
And then there's this other term here, which is the displacement current term, and it's due to EY, which is the same EY as in the previous view graph.
Now you integrate Ampere's law around the loop and you get this. Okay? Now this can be readily simplified.
We have therefore these two equations, they're the ones I just wrote down, and I've replaced J by sigma E using Ohm's law. Okay? Let's take dVz of this equation, eliminate B, and we end up with this equation here.
For the electric field. This time inside a conductor. Now I've derived the wave equation for electric fields in a vacuum, right? Or in a dielectric. This is the wave equation inside a conductor. It's very different. Okay? Well, first thing we have to know is that this is more complicated than it has to be. If k naught is omega over c, then the ratio of k naught squared to this omega sigma mu naught is 10 to the minus 7 at 1, 10 to the minus 9 at 1 gigahertz. This displacement current term is absolutely negligible. We can get rid of it. And we're just left with this term. Displacement current effects are negligible in good conductors, which is just as well because you can't have any charge there. Right? Remember I said on the transmission line you had that charge accumulation? Can't happen inside a conductor, so you can't have propagation in the same way. Alright, so we get this simpler equation, and this equation has the following solution. Interestingly, because this is taking the square root of j here, you end up with 1 plus j over delta, where delta is this quantity here. Who knows what delta is?
What's delta? From reading the lab notes. Right?
This is the equation of an electric field propagating into a conductor, and I should have drawn a picture of it.
So here's the surface of the conductor. And the electric field comes in, and then you've got this exponentially damped propagating term that does this.
It's damped, isn't it? It's damped by an amount 1 over delta. Within a distance delta, it's damped by 1 over E, about a factor of 3. Down after the electric field is damped down after delta.
How big? What is delta first? What is it called?
I've got it up there.
Skin depth. Does anyone remember that from their lab notes last week?
It's the skin depth, exactly. This is the derivation of the skin depth. So when an electric field impinges on a metal, it does penetrate a bit. It penetrates by the skin depth. The skin depth is zero when sigma is infinite. So an infinite conductor doesn't penetrate at all. Okay? As the frequency goes up, it penetrates even less. Okay? A very important quantity. You'll see skin depth arise in many areas outside radio. The other thing that's a bit funny is it's actually a propagating wave too, because it has a J there. And the propagation factor and the damping factor are exactly the same. Regardless of the frequency, they're exactly the same. So electromagnetic waves only penetrate a distance of delta into the metal. Okay, so check the magnitude of delta. How big was it roughly for someone? Copper at a megahertz. Who can give me a ballpark figure? I don't care. Yes, tiny, wasn't it? Fractions of a millimeter at a megahertz. Okay, so it's for copper though. All right, going one step further. Now we have this electromagnetic wave.
It propagates in, it hits the metal surface. It immediately induces a current on that surface. What's the current J given by? For a metal, J equals? Yeah, sigma E, exactly.
So whenever you've got electric field in a metal,
J equals sigma E, no matter where you are in the metal. Unfortunately, you can't get too far in. That's what we just learned.
All right. Okay, now, let's suppose we define this. What's happened is the electric field oscillates around like this according to that exponentially damped factor there, and so there's a current. There's a current that does exactly the same thing, and it's just given by multiplying this thing by sigma, okay? Or actually EY. EY0 is the electric field at the surface, okay? And now if we integrate the current, J, into the surface as far as we can go, well beyond delta, you end up with this relationship between the current and EY0. Now this current IS is actually the current per unit width, because this has dimensions, depth in the x direction, okay? And so if we integrate the current per unit area flowing on the surface in a distance, we actually end up with current per unit width in the cross-sectional, in this direction here, okay? So that's why I've called it IS. It is not the same thing as current. Well, not yet, anyway. I'll show you in a minute how you get it. So you end up then with this relationship here between IS and the electric field, sigma delta over 1 plus J. And if I just take that, we can now define a new impedance called the impedance per square, which is electric field divided by current per unit width. And it's given by this formula. Now you've seen that in the notes already, okay? Impedance per square, unfortunately, electric field is voltage per unit length, and IS is current per unit width, so impedance per square is kind of a funny name to give it. It sounds like you're running out of ways to think about relating it to specific quantities. But if you've got an impedance per square, now suppose you have a conductor of length L, in other words, going up here, L is now the length of this conductor, no matter how long that is. And let's suppose it's a wire of radius A, so that the perimeter of the wire near its surface, assuming delta is small, the skin depth is small, is equal to, therefore, 2 pi A, then the impedance of that wire is given by L over 2 pi A times ZS. Now, that's a very important formula because it tells you the impedance of a wire, okay, the internal impedance of the wire. It relates the voltage, the electric field on the surface, to the current on the inside, and that's only part of the story, okay? Now, the reason why this is important is because we run into trouble with resistance at radio frequency. Every wire acts like a resistor and an inductor, because every wire, as we'll see, has external inductance, and it has internal impedance, and I've just given you the internal bit here, okay? The internal impedance has both a resistive and an inductive part. In fact, they're both equal. It's 1 plus J, so it's half resistor and half inductor. This impedance is half resistance and half inductance. Okay, now, it immediately leads you to a problem to make a resistor. If a resistor is to be made out of material that has finite conductivity, which is what a resistor is, then what do you do at radio frequency to stop skin effect stuffing you up and causing this J to appear? Okay? I'll leave you to think about how you're going to go about making a resistor. But I'll do that. In the next lecture, I'll introduce the simple resistor. I've already done it for you, actually. Rho L on A, inadvertently, 1 over sigma R L on A. But we'll have a look at how it is you have to make a resistor at radio frequency. Because you'll find that some resistors that you get out of a drawer, wire-wound resistors, for example, are nothing but inductors at radio frequency. They don't behave like resistors at all. On the other hand, there are other resistors, such as some carbon resistors and metal film resistors, that are specifically designed for use at radio frequency. Or just happen to be good at radio frequency in some cases. Okay? All right, and we're going to see why with this. So we'll have a look at these ideas in more detail in the lab this afternoon. Any questions? No, okay.
Yeah, there was. All these. Oh, sorry.